Major support for Backstory is provided by the National Endowment for the Humanities.
From the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, this is Backstory with the American History Guys. Welcome to the show. I'm Brian Ballow, 20th Century Guy, and I'm here with Ed Ayers.
You're 19th Century Guy.
And Peter Onuf.
The 18th Century Guy.
This is kind of a big week for us. Some of you might have heard us occasionally on your radio or as a podcast in the past, but now we're taking the next big step.
Yep. Backstory with American History Guys is now coming to you every single week.
So get used to us.
And this being a new beginning for us, we thought, well, why not tackle a subject in American history that's all about beginnings? We're going to take on birth.
Now, it's true that the biology of childbirth is more or less of a constant over time, but there are a lot of differences between what it means to be born an American today and what it meant in, say, the 18th century, and that's what we're going to be talking about today.
We'll begin with one of the first items of consideration for new parents, the name. It's such a big deal for people these days, so we got to wondering how previous generations of Americans handled that important event. And with a question like that, there's really only one person to turn to, somebody whose work I've been admiring for a long time, Laura Wattenberg.
Hi, nice to talk with you.
About a decade ago, Laura got curious and started looking through some baby name books. But those books weren't telling her the kind of stuff she really wanted to know.
The traditional baby name dictionary is sort of a dictionary of meanings and origins. So Cameron means crooked nose. But when you hear a name, you hear so much more than that.
Thank goodness.
Yes.
And so Laura embarked on this project, which turned into a website, of course, and it was called babynamewizard.com. The website features these nifty graphs showing trends for over 7,000 names, and they go back all the way to the 1880s.
Laura, I have a question for you. Thinking back way before your time into the 18th century and before, I'm thinking of Puritan New England and the use of names like Prudence and Thankful. I mean, Prudence survives. But they describe qualities. They often have a spiritual dimension. And there's clearly some kind of theory that the name will be a kind of destiny. What intentions do you see in the naming act itself? Do parents think they're doing something for the child by the name?
I think naming a child is one of the most honest acts we have in our society, that parents are really encoding their values and hopes and dreams. Mm-hmm. So definitely the Puritan names, what they showed, in addition to a piety, there was a lot of humility. There were value names, but they tended to be very humble ones.
Right. Right.
Today we're seeing a new rise of quality and value names, but they tend to aggrandize the child more. So we're seeing destiny and miracle, and even a lot of children named Messiah. It used to be that names were not subject to fashion at all. Up until around the Industrial Revolution, you really were looking at John and Mary, James and Elizabeth. And for centuries and centuries in English, those sort of royal, kingly and queenly names dominated. That held true in the U.S. for boys all the way through the middle of the 20th century, for girls a little bit earlier. And since then, for the last 50, 60 years, we have been on a roller coaster. So starting in the 50s, Linda was the first name to knock off Mary as number one.
Wow.
Then we had Jennifer and Lisa and Jessica.
All the names of my old girlfriends. I don't know what that tells me.
Exactly.
Laura, I'm looking at your website right now, and I notice a number of names that are becoming popular today, names like Silas and Violet, Evelyn. When I actually trace those, what I find is those names were popular, you know, more than 100 years ago. Why is it that people are reaching back so far for a name?
I think some people go to the past to be fresh, but the key thing we all have in common is we don't want the names of our own generation, because that's ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
Our parents' generation is boring. Our grandparents are old. So you either have to go back another generation or create something entirely new.
And what about totally invented names? Why go back
why not simply string together some letters? I mean, think of car naming, Sentra, you know?
Actually, we're seeing a lot of car names and baby names rising together. So, as soon as the Sienna became a minivan,
Sienna,
it also became
right.
a popular name. The funny part about all of this is we all want to be different from each other, but our tastes are all very much the same.
Yeah.
And so what we're seeing is a lot of tiny variations on a theme that instead of just Aiden, you have Caden, Braden, Jaden, and Zayden. Because that's the sound that sounds good to every parent. So to be a little bit different, you add an extra Y. Maybe you choose the video game name Raiden, and you all end up sounding the same.
Wow.
That was Laura Wattenberg, founder of BabyNameWizard.com.
Guys, just fascinating. And what it underlines is how important it's become for newborns to have a unique, meaningful, and memorable name, a name that really marks that kid as special. But as we heard from Laura Wattenberg, that wasn't always the case.
For the rest of the hour, we're going to look at some of the other aspects of American childbirth that we tend to really take for granted today, and we're going to give them the backstory treatment, seeing how they've changed over time.
One aspect of childbirth I think it's pretty safe to say almost all of us take for granted now is the notion that babies are innocent, that they're untainted by the harsh realities of the world.
Of course they are.
Yeah, and that until these babies grow up and prove otherwise, we can assume that they're good, that they're pure. Well, guys, I am here to tell you that even this has a history. In fact, in Puritan New England, and I'm happy to say this is the 17th century, not my century, the assumption was exactly the opposite. For Puritans, there was every reason to believe that if a child died before the so-called age of accountability, that would be 6 or 7 years old, there was every reason to believe that the child was going to go straight to hell.
Gosh, that's harsh.
Okay, just relax. I want to share with you guys a wildly popular poem from this era. It's called Day of Doom, and the stanza you're about to hear is written from the point of view of recently deceased infants who are appealing to God to spare them from an eternity in hell.
O great Creator, why was our nature depraved and forlorn? Why so defiled and made so vile whilst we were yet unborn? If it be just and needs we must transgressors reckoned be, thy mercy, Lord, to us afford, which sinners hath set free.
That's a stanza from The Day of Doom, written by poet Michael Wigglesworth and published in 1662. It was read by Peggy Bendroth, a religion scholar at the Congregational Library in Boston. We've invited her onto the show today to help us understand this bizarre-sounding notion that newborns, by the simple virtue of being human, were damned from the outset. Welcome to the show, Peggy.
Thank you.
Peggy, help us. Who is this guy Michael Wigglesworth, and why has he got such a gloomy, doomy view of the world?
Well, apparently he wasn't someone that you would probably enjoy a cozy evening with. He was one of the first Puritans to arrive in New England. He was taught at Harvard. He was a pastor in Malden here in Massachusetts. He was probably the extreme caricature of anything you've ever thought about Puritans, being dour and full of guilt and worry and fear. That's him.
But by the standards of the day, Day of Doom was a bestseller. I mean, what's
apparently
wrong with
so
these Puritans?
Also.
Yes.
Yes.
So the caricature
yes.
actually applies to a broad readership as well.
Yeah, apparently there was a readership for this kind of thing. Certainly it wouldn't have been out of the norm of what people would have heard preached in sermons or things like that.
So we have a baby. Babies are beautiful, right? We agree on that. But it's damned to hell. What's that all about? What does that mean, practically speaking?
Well, I think part of it is this, what they call the federal theory of original sin, and that we were all metaphysically present with Adam in the Garden of Eden, and we literally have his sin. Original sin is, of course, a very familiar concept in the history of Christian theology, and the idea that sin is not just something that we do, but it's something that we are, that by virtue of Adam's fall, we sinned all. It's not just kind of my individual peccadillo.
So what we get from infant damnation and original sin is a notion of humanity and the human condition that creates powerful links among us. It's a communal thing. This is a project. Yeah. We're trying to create a city upon a hill.
Exactly, yeah. And it's not every man or woman for themselves. Now, obviously, there were moments in the history of Puritanism when that city on a hill could be kind of a prison for people who wanted to think differently.
I don't think we'd want to go there, no.
None of us would. But yet, at the same time, there is kind of a loneliness in our culture today where we really have to perfect ourselves. We look for books. We look for exercise routines. We look for all different ways to kind of work on that project that is you instead of just saying, I share the same kind of common nature with everyone I see on the subway or I'm passing on the highway.
I always think of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. I don't know if you spend time watching it now, but it made a big
imprint on me.
And Mr. Rogers likes us just the way we are.
Yeah.
And that's the last thing you'd expect from Michael Wigglesworth if he had a television program.
Yeah.
Isn't there a downside to that, isn't there? That it's this notion that you're entitled to all the love in the world just because you are you?
Yeah, I know. And there's something about this idea that the child is, in one sense, they're your child, your offspring. But in another sense, we really want them to be independent and have all kinds of self-confidence and make their way in the world. I remember dropping my children off for kindergarten. And of course, my children, I'm a bad parent. They clung to me and acted as if, you know, it was a slaughterhouse. And the other parents whose children simply walked away and said goodbye felt really good about themselves. And there's something about that that certainly a Puritan would not understand.
Right.
I think that the downside of this kind of independent, self-actualizing child, the child who is kind of their parents' project to be perfected and changed and beautified, in one way, it's an enormous responsibility on the parents, whether you really did a good job or not.
Yes, and Peggy, aren't you in danger of committing the sin of pride when you invest so much in this project?
Absolutely. That's right. And so when your child is a sinner just like you and shares the same nature, in a way, you're kind of in this together.
That was Peggy Bendroth. She's the executive director of the Congregational Library in Boston.
Today on the show, we're looking at a few of the basic assumptions we have about childbirth today and asking how things in the past have been different.
I've got a pretty good idea of what birth looks like today. You've got your doctors, you've got all kinds of specialists waiting in the wings, and you have lots and lots of machines just beeping away. I have a hunch, though, that that's not what things have been for most of American history. I want you to tell me what the history of birth was really like before we got to all this technology.
That's a pretty bold statement, Brian, to guess that we didn't have big electronic machines back in the days before we had electronic machines. But I like when you venture beyond your comfort zone in the 20th century there.
Yeah, I know.
Now, it turns out we can answer that question in pretty stunning detail because of a meticulous diary kept by a midwife from 200 years ago named Martha Ballard. We know about that diary because of the remarkable work of a historian from modern times named Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. About 20 years ago, she published a groundbreaking book about Ballard's work as a midwife in rural Maine. It covered the years between 1785 and 1812. And that was a harrowing time, certainly, to have a baby, especially perhaps in rural America. I sat down with Ulrich to talk about the challenges of delivering babies in such a challenging time.
Working with a diary of an 18th century midwife, I was really surprised. The birth itself was pretty uneventful in her diary. Most of the time, things went very well. The difficulty was, you know, going on a floating cake of ice across the river to get to a mother, or falling off her horse, or being in the middle of a rainstorm and mud. So the challenge for her was getting there.
And I guess before she could go to get there, word had to get to her in some way too, right? That must have been another part of the challenge.
So it's a lot of running back and forth.
Right. And how many times would she have done this?
Well, she delivered over the course of her career more than 1,000 babies.
Oh, gosh.
And maybe the high point would be 50 babies in 1 year.
Would a woman think going into childbirth almost every time that she might not come back out the other side?
I think so. but remarkably, in the 1,000 births that Martha Ballard officiated at, she didn't lose a single woman at delivery.
Wow.
The fact that these deliveries were spread out and they took place at home meant that there was a lot less danger of infection. The thing that happened when deliveries moved, well, there were deliveries in hospitals in the 18th century, but only for the indigent. And people died rampantly because infection would spread. People didn't have an understanding of asepsis at all. Things weren't sterilized. There was no germ theory. And so if a physician, for example, were using instruments and delivering a number of women using the same equipment, germs could spread rapidly.
Well, this remarkable record raises a question. If she was literally batting 1,000, why do midwives decline in favor of doctors? And when does that happen?
Well, that is a fascinating story. Midwives actually persisted in the United States almost to modern times, but among educated, middle-class, urban families beginning in the 19th century, by 1840s and 50s, more and more people were using physicians. And there was a belief in scientific advancement among these people, even though actually there was no scientific advancement, we know, but there was a hope for that.
But kind of a placebo effect on a social level, right?
Yeah. Yeah, or there was, you know, this was an era where specialists are going to do things better, people felt. But I think there are really factors that are far more important. One of them is that the medical profession changed. In the 18th century, when Martha Ballard was in her practice, doctors were gentlemen who relied primarily on book learning. They certainly didn't want to get their hands dirty. Medicine became a more empirical occupation. People were interested in evidence and practice, actually getting involved. And doctors learned to behave like midwives. You know, that's kind of the opposite of what we think. We tend to think, oh, it was the aura of science. But actually, I think it was doctors learned to have a gentle, nurturing manner, and they would come to the home, and they would be comfortable with the women. Some people think fathers first attended deliveries maybe as doctors began to officiate. That may or may not be so in every place, but you do get a little bit more engagement of husbands and fathers in the 19th century than in earlier periods.
Laurel Thatcher Ulrich is professor of history at Harvard University. So guys, the story that Laurel Ulrich tells brings us up to the turn of the 20th century. And here's something surprising. Even then, half the births in America are still delivered by midwives. And even if they are delivered by doctors, the vast majority of births are still taking place at someone's home. It would take another four decades to 1938 before half of American births took place in hospitals. And here's the most amazing stat. Between 1938 and 1955, we went from 50% hospital births to 99% hospital births. So, Brian, can you tell us how that came about? Why did it take so long for hospital births to catch on? And once they did catch on, why have they held on so tenaciously?
Well, it's a pretty complicated story, Ed.
Well, and I'll go boil some water and we'll settle in.
Exactly. And if you'll excuse the pun, it's a push-pull factor here. Here's what the push into hospitals was from. People were moving to cities at increased pace. They were losing some of those networks that they had relied on, and they did not have the family and the midwives available in an urban setting that they had had in those rural settings. And so this pushed them to hospitals. What pulled them? After World War II, the reputation of scientists in general just soared, and of course doctors had now invented medications like penicillin. Frankly, experts were never more revered than the period roughly 1950 up to 1970-80.
I hope you'll indulge me in a brief moment of autobiography. When I was born, my mom and dad were 20, 21 years old, and they lived way up in the mountains of North Carolina. I was born in January. And through a driving snowstorm, my dad drove a pickup truck 40 miles with my mom in it to Asheville, North Carolina, so I could be born in a hospital.
Wow.
So, you know, it seems like a funny accepting this risk of, you know, of driving off the side of a mountain with a pickup truck with cinder blocks in the back so it would be heavy so that I could be born in a hospital.
To get to those beeping machines.
Yeah, exactly. Now, that's 1953, which puts it smack in the middle of this trend. It's interesting to know that even we live in history.
So, we've covered the hospitals, we've covered the names, we've covered the inherent goodness of the child, but there's another aspect of being born in America that's varied pretty greatly over time. And that is, when you're born, how long have you been considered alive already?
Now, the question of when life begins is a pretty touchy subject, and you'll not be surprised to know that we're not going to decide it here on Backstory one way or the other.
Yeah.
But we are going to look at it through historical eyes. And throughout American history, there have been those who have been forced to make that call, and that's the courts. After all, you have to be considered a person rather than, for instance, a fetus before you can be granted basic legal rights.
In the middle of the 19th century, some courts started ruling that a fetus could be named as a beneficiary in a will. So, for instance, if you wanted to leave your grandson some land, but he hadn't quite been born yet, that was okay. But in 1884, this question of personhood came before the courts in a fascinating and a much more complicated way. The case was called Dietrich v. the inhabitants of Northampton, Massachusetts.
There was a woman named Charlotte Francis, and she was walking on the street in Northampton, Massachusetts, and there was, as the court put it, a defect in the sidewalk. And I've seen that described in various places, everywhere from, you know, a crack to a gaping hole. But, you know, there was a defect in the sidewalk.
This is Jessica Waters, a law professor at American University.
So she was approximately 5 months pregnant and generally acknowledged, you know, prior to fetal viability, meaning that the fetus could not survive outside of the woman. So she falls, and this leads to a miscarriage. She ends up suing the city. And what she did was interesting because she sued not only for injuries to herself, but she also sued for injuries to the miscarried baby. So the court was faced with the question of, could the baby recover? She actually won in a jury trial for the injuries to herself, meaning, you know, whatever, you know, bumps and bruises she had suffered, and then separately pursued the question of injuries to her baby.
Right.
So the case goes forward, and she wins at the jury trial for her injuries, but she lost for the baby's injuries and actually ended up having to pay court costs for the part of the case that she lost. She then appeals, and that's how it ended up before the Massachusetts Supreme Court.
The Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court was a true rock star of all of legal history, Oliver Wendell Holmes. So however he decided the Dietrich case, people were going to respect that, and it was basically going to become the precedent for the entire country.
He basically comes to the conclusion that a fetus who is unable to live outside of the mother's womb does not have standing to sue, right? In other words, the fetus is part of the woman, part of the mother at the time of the injury.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, the fetus does not have a separate standing to bring a suit on its own behalf.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is the law of the land for, you know, the next 50, 60 years.
But in 1946, things started to shift in a landmark case on this issue called Bonbrest v. Kotz.
There was a woman who was in labor, and the doctors were accused essentially of professional malpractice during the delivery of the child.
Mm-hmm.
The child ends up surviving the birth, but has injuries as a result of the delivery.
Just to be clear here, because these are injuries sustained during birth, but before the child is completely born, they're considered injuries to the fetus.
And the question became, could the child that was born alive sue for injuries, essentially, right? And the court now, in a sharp turn from Dietrich, says yes. There's an important point in the Bombrecht decision, and I'll quote it because I do think it's pretty critical, where the court, referring to the fetus, says, quote, "It has, if viable, its own bodily form and members, manifests all of the anatomical characteristics of individuality, possesses its own circulatory, vascular, and excretory systems, and is capable now of being ushered into the visible world."
Mm-hmm.
And goes on to say, again, importantly, quote, "The law is presumed to keep pace with the sciences, and medical science has certainly made progress since 1884, referring explicitly to the Dietrich case.
Sure.
Right? So you see the court, you know, changing course, and at least as a major part of its analysis, saying, hey, the science has changed, right? We know more than we did. And we're more comfortable saying that the fetus isn't only part of the mother, but is in fact a separate entity that can recover against a third party, essentially.
How much had medical practices in terms of viability of fetuses changed between the 1880s and in 1946 when Bombrecht was decided?
You know what's so, you know, and I'm not a doctor by any stretch.
Well, you sound like a lawyer now with that disclaimer.
I know, right? What's my training coming out? So I'm not a doctor. I am, in fact, 7 months pregnant, however, so I'm intimately familiar with a lot of this.
So I'm really interviewing two of you. I want that duly,
you are.
I want that duly noted in my paycheck here at Backstory.
Depending on who you ask, right?
Yes.
Are you interviewing two of us or one of us?
That's right.
But it's interesting because I've been looking over some of the critiques of the Dietrich decision in the past couple of days. And there are several commentators who say, this is sort of crazy, you know, that the science hadn't changed that dramatically mm-hmm. between Dietrich and Bombrecht. What we're certainly seeing, however, is a greater recognition of the science by the courts.
Right. Over the next several decades, rulings trended towards giving more rights to the fetus. By 1960, 18 different states had awarded damages for death or injury to the unborn. And while the question of fetal personhood had more or less existed separate from the question of abortion, the definition of personhood and abortion would become forever linked in 1973 in the case of Roe v. Wade.
In Roe, we see the court point blank saying, the fetus is not a person under the 14th Amendment. And this was actually, you know, a fairly interesting colloquy during the oral argument. Sarah Weddington, who argued on behalf of Jane Roe, was explicitly asked the question, you know, if a fetus is a person, do you lose? And she said, yes, I lose,
yes.
Right, very explicitly.
And this is very important. In the past year, lawmakers in Alabama, Virginia, Oklahoma, and Mississippi have all considered measures that would define a human embryo as a person from the moment of conception. Sponsors of these initiatives say they're simply trying to provide protection for fetuses against wrongful death, not abortion. Again, they're trying to separate those two issues. So far, none of the measures has been enacted, but there's a line of thinking that says if they do become law and the Supreme Court upholds that personhood starts at the moment of conception, Roe v. Wade would be voided. There's another chapter here. In 2004, the federal government passed the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. It said, if you harm a woman at any stage of pregnancy and the fetus is also harmed, it's considered two separate crimes because you've harmed two people. You don't need to intend harm to the fetus. You don't even need to know the woman is pregnant. So given all of this, I just had to ask Jessica Waters in what direction she sees the rights of the unborn trending.
Yeah, I think that's the million-dollar question. We see the court signaling a much greater willingness to recognize the state's increased interest in protecting a fetus. However, where we do see what I would call a remarkable inconsistency with abortion law are questions of, can states criminalize or in other ways penalize pregnant women for their actions while pregnant, right? So if a pregnant woman uses illegal drugs while pregnant,
right,
or, you know, engages in some form of activity that's thought to be dangerous to the pregnancy, can she be liable?
Right.
And we see some courts saying yes, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we've even seen some courts, you know, deal with the question of, you know, can a woman face liability for failure to consent to a C-section, you know, at the end of pregnancy? And we see some courts saying yes, right? So we're starting to see an increased willingness to, again, perhaps weigh the interests of the fetus over that of the pregnant woman.
Jessica Waters is a professor of law at American University.
It's time for a short break. When we get back, we'll look at why the idea of birthright citizenship has been an embattled one from the very beginning. And we'll take a few of your calls. You're listening to Backstory. We'll be back in a minute.